If life transcends death, then I will seek for you there. If not, then there too, she said. It's a fucking haiku. That man has a one-track mind and one train on it. Poetry. Save me from poetry. They didn't understand, but they didn't need to. The real message came 5 hours later. It came on a public news feed, and it was delivered by Secretary General Esteban Sorrento Gillis. The old man was brilliant at looking somber and energetic at the same time. If he hadn't been the executive of the largest governing body in the history of the human race, he'd have made a killing promoting health drinks. The whole crew had gathered by now. Amos, Naomi, Holden, Alex, even Prax. They were sandwiched into the ops deck, their combined breaths just slightly overloading the recyclers and giving the deck a feeling of barn heat. All eyes were on the screen as the Secretary General took the podium. I have come here tonight to announce the immediate formation of an investigative committee. Accusations have been made that some individuals within the governing body of the United Nations and its military forces have taken unauthorized and possibly illegal steps in dealing with certain private contractors. If these accusations are true, they must be addressed in the most expedient possible manner. And if unfounded, they must be dispelled and those responsible for spreading these lies called to account. I need not remind you all of the years I spent as a political prisoner. Oh, fuck me, Avasarala said, clapping her hands in glee. He's using the outsider speech. That man's asshole must be tight enough right now to bend space. I have dedicated my terms as Secretary General to rooting out corruption, and as long as I have this gavel, I shall continue to do so. Our world and the solar system we all share must be assured that the United Nations honors the ethical, moral, and spiritual values that hold us all together as a species. On the feed, Esteban Sorrento Gillis nodded, turned, and strode away in a clamor of unacknowledged questions, and the commentators flowed into the space, talking over each other and all the political opinions of the spectrum. Okay, Holden said. So, did he actually say anything? He said Ehrenreich is finished, Avasarala said. If he had any influence left at all, that announcement would never have been made. God damn, I wish I was there. Ehrenreich was off the board. All that left was Nguyen, Mao, Strickland, or whoever he was, their half-controlled protomolecule warriors, and the building threat of Venus. She let a long breath rattle through her throat and the spaces behind her nose. Ladies and gentlemen, she said, I have just solved our smallest problem. Chapter 46. Bobby. One of Bobby's most vivid memories was of the day she got her orders to report to the 2nd Expeditionary Force Spec War Training Facility, Force Recon, the top of the heap for a Martian ground pounder. In boot camp, they'd trained with a Force Recon sergeant. He'd been wearing a suit of gleaming red power armor, and they'd watched him demonstrate its use in a variety of tactical situations. At the end, he told them that the top 4 boots from her class would be transferred to the Spec War facility on the slopes of Hecate's Tholus and trained to wear the armor and join the baddest fighting unit in the solar system. She decided that meant her. Determined to win one of those 4 coveted slots, she'd thrown herself into her boot camp training with everything she had. It turned out that was quite a lot. Not only did she make it into the top 4, she was number 1 by an embarrassing margin. And then the letter came, ordering her to report to Hecate Base for recon training, and it was all worth it. She called her father, and just screamed for 2 minutes. When he finally got her to calm down and tell him what she was calling about, he screamed back for even longer. "You're one of the best now, baby," he'd said at the end. And the warmth those words put in her heart had never really faded. Even now, sitting on the gray metal deck in the dirty machine shop on a stolen Martian warship, even with all her mates torn into pieces and scattered across the frozen surface of Ganymede, even with her military status in limbo and her loyalty to her nation justifiably in question, even with all that, "You're one of the best now, baby," made her smile. She felt an ache to call her father and tell him what had happened. They'd always been close, and when neither of her brothers had followed in his footsteps by choosing a military career, she had. It had just strengthened the connection. She knew he'd understand what it was costing her to turn her back on everything she held sacred to avenge her team. And she had a powerful premonition she'd never see him again. Even if they made it through to Jupiter with half the UN fleet hunting them, and even if when they got there, Admiral Nguyen and the dozen or more ships he controlled didn't immediately blow them out of the sky, and even if they managed to stop whatever was happening in orbit around Io with the Rosinante intact, Holden was still planning to land and save Prax's daughter. The monsters would be there. She knew it as surely as she'd ever known anything in her life. Each night, she dreamed of facing it again. The thing flexing its long fingers and staring at her with its two large, glowing blue eyes, ready to finish what it had started all those months earlier on Ganymede. In her dream, she raised a gun that grew out of her hand and started shooting it as it ran toward her, black spider webs spilling from holes that closed like water. She always woke before it reached her, but she knew how the dream would end, with her shattered body left cooling on the ice. She also knew that when Holden led his team down to the laboratories on Io where the monsters were made, she'd go along with him. The scene from her dream would play out in real life. She knew it like she knew her father's love. She welcomed it. On the floor around her lay the pieces of her armor. With weeks of travel on the way to Io, she had time to completely strip and refit it. The Rosinante's machine shop was well stocked, and the tools were of Martian make. It was the perfect location. The suit had seen a lot of use without much maintenance, but if she was being honest with herself, the distraction was the payoff. A suit of Martian reconnaissance armor was an incredibly complex machine, finely tuned to its wearer. Stripping and reassembling it wasn't a trivial task. It required full concentration. Every moment she spent working on it was another moment when she didn't think about the monster waiting to kill her on Io. Sadly, that distraction was over now. She'd finished with the maintenance, even finding the microfracture in a tiny valve that was causing the slow but persistent leak of fluid in the suit's knee actuator. It was time to just put it all back together. It had the feeling of ritual, a final cleansing before going out to meet death on the battlefield. "I've watched too many Kurosawa movies," she thought, but couldn't quite abandon the idea. The imagery was a lovely way of turning angst and suicidal ideation into honor and noble sacrifice. She picked up the torso assembly and carefully wiped it off with a damp cloth, removing the last bits of dust and machine oil that clung to the outside. The smell of metal and lubricant filled the air. And while she bolted armor plating back onto the frame, the red enameled surface covered with 1,000 dings and scratches, she stopped fighting the urge to ritualize the task and just let it happen. She was very likely assembling her death shroud. Depending on how the final battle went, this ceramic and rubber and alloy might house her corpse for the rest of eternity. She flipped the torso assembly over and began working on the back. A long gouge in the enamel showed the violence of her passage across Ganymede's ice when the monster had self-destructed right in front of her. She picked up a wrench, then put it back down, tapping on the deck with her knuckle. Why then? Why had the monster blown itself up at that moment? She remembered the way it had started to shift, new limbs bursting from its body as it watched her. If Prax was right, that was the moment the constraint systems that Mao's scientists had installed failed, and they'd set the bomb up to detonate if the creature was getting out of their control. But that just pushed the question one level back. Why had their control over the creature's physiology failed at that precise moment? Prax said that regenerative processes were a good place for constraint systems to fail, and her platoon had riddled the creature with gunfire as it had charged their lines. It hadn't seemed to hurt it at the time, but each wound represented a sudden burst of activity inside the creature's cells, or whatever it had in place of cells, as the monster healed. Each was a chance for the new growth to slip the leash. Maybe that was the answer. Don't try to kill the monster. Just damage it enough that the program starts to break down and the self-destruct kicks in. She wouldn't even have to survive. Just last long enough to harm the monster beyond its ability to safely repair itself. All she needed was enough time to really hurt it. She put down the armor plate she was working on and picked up the helmet. The suit's memory still had the gun camera footage of the fight on it. She hadn't watched it again after Avasarala's presentation to the crew of the Rossi. She hadn't been able to. She pushed herself to her feet and hit the comm panel on the wall. "Hey, Naomi, you an ops?" "Yep," Naomi said after a few seconds. "You need something, Sergeant." "Do you think you can tell the Rossi to talk to my helmet? I've got the radio on, but it won't talk to civilian stuff. This is one of our boats, so I figure the Rossi has the keys and codes." There was a long pause, so Bobby put the helmet on a work table next to the closest wall monitor and waited. "I'm seeing a radio node that the Rossi is calling MCRMR Goliath 3-243-97A15. "That's me," Bobby said. "Can you send control of that node down to the panel in the machine shop?" "Done," Naomi said after a second. "Thanks," Bobby said, and killed the comm. It took her a moment to refamiliarize herself with the Martian military video software and to convince the system to use out-of-date data unpacking algorithms. After a few false starts, the raw gun camera footage from her fight on Ganymede was playing on the screen. She set it to endless loop and sat back down on the deck with her suit. She finished bolting the back armor on and began attaching the torso's power supply and main hydraulic system during the first playthrough. She tried not to feel anything about the images on screen, nor to attach any significance to them or think of them as a puzzle to be solved. She just concentrated on her work on the suit with her mind and let her subconscious chew on the data from the screen. The distraction caused her to redo things occasionally as she worked, but that was fine. She wasn't on a deadline. She finished attaching the power supply and main motors. Green lights lit up on the hand terminal she had plugged into the suit's brain. On the wall screen by her helmet, a UN soldier was hurled across the surface of Ganymede at her. A confusion of images as she dodged away. When the image steadied, both the UN Marine and her friend Tev Hillman were gone. Bobby picked up an arm assembly and began reattaching it to the torso. The monster had picked up a soldier in a suit of armor comparable to her own, and then thrown him with enough force to kill instantly. There was no defense against that kind of strength, except not to get hit. She concentrated on putting the arm back together. When she looked up at the screen again, the feed had restarted. The monster was running across the ice, chasing the UN soldiers. It killed one of them. The bobby on the video began firing, followed by her entire platoon opening up. The creature was fast, but when the UN soldiers suddenly turned to open a firing lane for the Martians, the creature didn't react quickly. So maybe fast in a straight line, but not a lot of lateral speed. That might be useful. The video caught up again to the UN soldier being thrown into Private Hillman. The creature reacted to gunfire, to injuries, even though they didn't slow it down. She thought back to the video she'd seen of Holden and Amos engaging the creature in the Rocinante's cargo hold. It had largely ignored them until Amos started shooting it, and then it had erupted into violence. But the first creature had attacked the UN troop station, so at least to some degree they could be directed, given orders. Once they no longer had orders, they seemed to lapse into a default state of trying to get increased energy and break the constraints. While in that state, they ignored pretty much everything but food and violence. The next time she ran into one, unless it had specifically been ordered to attack her, she could probably pick her own battleground, draw it to her where she wanted to be. That was useful too. She finished attaching the arm assembly and tested it, greens across the board. Even if she wasn't sure whom she was working for, at least she hadn't forgotten how to do her job. On the screen, the monster ran up the side of the big mech Yojimbo and tore the pilot's hatch off. Said, the pilot, was hurled away, again with the ripping and throwing. It made sense. With a combination like enormous strength and virtual immunity to ballistic damage, as your tool said, running straight at your opponent, then ripping them in two, was a pretty winning strategy. Throwing heavy objects at lethal speeds went hand in hand with the strength, and kinetic energy was a bitch. Armor might deflect bullets or lasers and might help cushion impacts, but no one had ever made armor that could shrug off all the kinetic energy imparted by a large mass moving at high speed. At least, not in something a human could wear. If you were strong enough, a garbage dumpster was better than a gun. So, when the monster attacked, it ran straight at its enemy, hoping to get a grip on them, which pretty much ended the fight. If it couldn't do that, it tried to hurl heavy objects at the opponent. The one in the cargo bay had nearly killed Jim Holden by throwing a massive crate. Unfortunately, her armor had a lot of the same restrictions it had. While it made her very fast when she wanted to be, it was not particularly good at lateral movement. Most things built for speed weren't. Cheetahs and horses didn't do a lot of sideways running. She was strong in her suit, but not nearly as strong as it was. She did have an advantage with firearms in that she could run away from the creature while continuing to attack from range. The creature couldn't throw a massive object at her without stopping and anchoring itself. It might be ungodly strong, but it still only weighed what it weighed, and Newton had a few things to say about a light object throwing a heavy one. By the time she'd finished assembling her suit, she'd watched the video over 100 times, and the tactics of the fight were starting to take shape in her head. In hand-to-hand combat training, she'd been able to overpower most of her opponents, but the small and quick fighters, the ones who knew how to stick and move, gave her trouble. That was who she'd be in this fight. She'd have to hit and run, never stopping for a moment. And even then, she'd need a lot of luck, because she was fighting way out of her weight class, and one shot from the monster was a guaranteed knockout. Her other advantage was that she didn't really have to win. She just had to do enough damage to make the monster kill itself. By the time she'd climbed into her newly refurbished suit and let it close around her for a final test, she was pretty sure she could do that. Bobby thought her newfound peace about the battle to come would finally let her sleep, but after 3 hours of tossing and turning in her rack, she gave up. Something still itched at the back of her head. She was trying to find her Bushido, and there were still too many things she couldn't let go of. Something wasn't giving her permission yet. So she pulled on a large fuzzy bathrobe she'd stolen from the Guanxiyin and rode the ladder lift up toward the ops deck. It was third watch, so the ship was deserted. Holden and Naomi had a cabin together, and she found herself envying that human contact right now. Something certain to cling to, amid all the other uncertainty. Avasarala was in her borrowed cabin, probably sending messages to people back on Earth. Alex would be asleep in his room, and for a brief moment, she considered waking him. She liked the gregarious pilot. He was genuine, in a way she hadn't seen much of since leaving active duty. But she also knew that waking a man up at 3 a.m. while in her bathrobe sent signals she didn't intend. Rather than try to explain that she just needed to talk to someone, she passed the crew deck by and kept going. Amos was sitting at a station in ops with his back to her, taking the late watch. To avoid startling him, she cleared her throat. He didn't move or react, so she walked to the comm station. Looking back at him, she saw that his eyes were closed and his breathing was very deep and regular. Sleeping on a duty watch would get you captain's mast at the least on an MCRN ship. It seemed Holden had let discipline lapse a bit since his Navy days. Bobby opened up the comms and found the closest relay for tight beam traffic. First, she called her father. "Hi, Pop. Not sure you should try and answer this. The situation here is volatile and evolving rapidly. But you may hear a lot of crazy shit over the next few days. Some of it might be about me. Just know that I love you guys and I love Mars. Everything I did was to try and protect you and my home. I might have lost my way a little bit because things got complicated and hard to figure out. But I think I see a clear path now, and I'm going to take it. I love you and Mom. Tell the boys they suck." Before she turned off the recording, she reached out and touched the screen. "Bye, Dad." She pressed send, but something still felt incomplete. Outside her family, anyone who'd tried to help her in the last 3 months was sitting on the same ship she was, so it didn't make sense. Except, of course, that it did. Because not everyone was on this ship. Bobby punched up another number from memory and said, "Hi, Captain Martins, it's me. I think I know what you were trying to help me see. I wasn't ready for it then, but it stuck with me. So you didn't waste your time. I get it now. I know this wasn't my fault. I know I was just at the wrong place at the wrong time. I'm going back to the start now because I understand. Not angry, not hurt, not blaming myself. Just my duty to finish the fight." Something loosened in her chest the moment she hit the send button. All the threads had been neatly tied up, and now she could go to Io and do what she needed to do without regret. She let out a long sigh and slid down in the crash couch until she was almost prone. She suddenly felt bone tired, like she could sleep for a week. She wondered if anyone would get mad if she just crashed out in ops instead of going all the way back down the lift. She didn't remember having fallen asleep. But here she was, stretched out in the comm station's crash couch, a small puddle of drool next to her head. To her relief, her robe seemed to have remained mostly in place, so at least she hadn't bare-assed everyone walking through. "Gunny," Holden said in a tone of voice that meant he was saying it again. He was standing over her, a concerned look on his face. "Sorry, sorry," she said, sitting up and pulling her robe more tightly around her middle. "I needed to send out some messages last night. Must have been more tired than I thought." "Yeah," Holden said. "It's no problem. Sleep wherever you like." "Okay," Bobby said, backing toward the crew ladder. "With that, I think I'll go down and take a shower and try to turn back into a human." Holden nodded as she went, a strange smile on his face. "Sure. Meet me in the machine shop when you're dressed." "Roger that," she said, and bolted down the ladder. After a decadently long shower and a change into her clean red and gray utility uniform, she grabbed a cup of coffee from the galley and made her way back down to the machine shop. Holden was already there. He had a crate the size of a guitar case sitting on one of the workbenches, and a larger, square crate next to his feet on the deck. When she entered the compartment, he patted the crate on the table. "This is for you. I saw when you came on board that you seemed to be missing yours." Bobby hesitated a moment, then walked over to the crate and flipped it open. Inside sat a 2mm electrically fired 3-barrel Gatling gun, of the type the Marines designated a Thunderbolt Mark V. It was new and shiny, and exactly the type that would fit into her suit. "This is amazing," Bobby said after catching her breath, "but it's just an awkward club without ammo." Holden kicked the crate on the floor. 5,000 rounds of 2mm caseless. Incendiary tipped. "Incendiary? You forget. I've seen the monster up close, too. Armor piercing doesn't help at all. If anything, it reduces soft tissue damage. But since the lab stuck an incendiary bomb into all of them, I figure that means they aren't fireproof." Bobby lifted the heavy weapon out of the crate and put it on the floor next to her newly reassembled suit. "Oh, hell yes." Chapter 47. Holden. Holden sat at the combat control console on the operations deck and watched Ragnarok gather. Admiral Souther, who Avasarala had assured everyone was one of the good guys, had joined his ships with their small but growing fleet of Martians as they sped toward Io. Waiting for them in orbit around that moon were the dozen ships in Admiral Nguyen's fleet. More Martian and UN ships sped toward that location from Saturn and the Belt. By the time everyone got there, there would be something like 35 capital ships in the kill zone and dozens of smaller interceptors and corvettes like the Rocinante. 3 dozen capital ships. Holden tried to remember if there had ever been a fleet action of this size, and couldn't think of one. Including Admiral Nguyen's and Admiral Souther's flagships, there would be 4 Truman-class UN dreadnoughts in the final tally, and the Martians would have 3 Doniger-class battleships of their own, any one of which could depopulate a planet. The rest would be a mix of cruisers and destroyers. Not quite the heavy hitters the battleships were, but plenty powerful enough to vaporize the Rocinante, which, if he was being honest, was the part Holden was most worried about. On paper, his team had the most ships. With Souther and the Martians joining forces, they outnumbered the Nguyen contingent 2-1. But how many Earth ships would be willing to fire on their own, just because one admiral and a banished politician said so? It was entirely possible that if actual shooting started, a lot of UN ships might have unexplained comm failures and wait to see how it all came out. And that wasn't the worst case. The worst case was that a number of Southers' ships would switch sides once Martians started killing Earthers. The fight could turn into a whole lot of people pointing guns at each other, with no one knowing whom to trust. It could turn into a bloodbath. "We have twice as many ships," Avasarla said from her constant perch at the comm station. Holden almost objected, but changed his mind. In the end, it wouldn't matter. Avasarla would believe what she wanted to believe. She needed to think all her efforts had been worthwhile, that they were about to pay off when the fleet arrived and this Nguyen clown surrendered to her obviously superior force. The truth was, her version wasn't any more or less of fantasy than his. No one would know for sure until everyone knew for sure. "How long now?" Avasarla said, then sipped at the bulb of weak coffee she'd started making for herself in place of tea. Holden considered pointing out the navigation information the Rossi made available at every console and then didn't. Avasarla didn't want him to show her how to find it herself. She wanted him to tell her. She wasn't accustomed to pressing her own buttons. In her mind, she outranked him. Holden wondered what the chain of command actually looked like in this situation. How many illegal captains of stolen ships did it take to equal one disgraced UN official? That could tie a courtroom up for a few decades. He also wasn't being fair to Avasarla. It wasn't about making him take her orders, not really. It was about being in a situation that she was utterly untrained for, where she was the least useful person in the room and trying to assert some control, trying to reshape the space around her to fit with her mental image of herself. Or maybe she just needed to hear a voice. 18 hours now, Holden said. Most of the other ships that aren't part of our fleet will beat us there. And the ones that don't won't show up until it's over, so we can ignore them. 18 hours, Avasarla said. There was something like awe in her voice. Space is too fucking big. It's the same old story. He'd guessed right. She just wanted to talk, so he let her. What story? Empire. Every empire grows until its reach exceeds its grasp. We started out fighting over who got the best branches in one tree. Then we climb down and fight over a few kilometers worth of trees. Then someone starts riding horses and you get empires of hundreds or thousands of kilometers. Ships open up empire expansion across the oceans. The Epstein Drive gave us the outer planets. She trailed off and tapped out something on the comm panel. She didn't volunteer who she was sending messages to, and Holden didn't ask. When she was done, she said, "But the story is always the same. No matter how good your technology is, at some point you'll conquer territory that you can't hold on to."
"You're talking about the outer planets?"
"Not specifically," she said, her voice growing soft and thoughtful. "I'm talking about the entire fucking concept of empire. The Brits couldn't hold on to India or North America, because why should people listen to a king who's 6,000 kilometers away?" Holden tinkered with the air circulation nozzle on his panel, aiming it at his face. The cool air smelled faintly of ozone and oil.
"Logistics is always a problem."
"No kidding. Taking a dangerous trip 6,000 kilometers across the Atlantic so you can fight with colonists gives the enemy one hell of a home court advantage."
"At least," Holden said, "we Earthers figured that out before we picked a fight with Mars. It's even further. And sometimes the sun is in the way.
Some people have never forgiven us for not humbling Mars when we had the chance," Avasarla said. "I work for a few of them. Fucking idiots.
I thought the point of your story was that those people always lose in the end. Those people, she said, pushing herself to her feet and slowly heading toward the crew ladder, are not the real problem. Venus might be housing the advance party of the first empire whose grasp is as long as its reach. And this fucking protomolecule has exposed us for the petty, small-town bosses we are. We're getting ready to trade our solar system away, because we thought we could build airports out of bamboo and summon the cargo. Get some sleep, Holden said to her while she called up the ladder lift. We'll defeat one empire at a time. Maybe, she said, as she dropped out of sight. And the deck hatch banged shut behind her. Why isn't anyone shooting? Prax said. He'd come up to the operations deck, trailing after Naomi like a lost child. Now he was sitting at one of the many unused crash couches. He stared up at the main screen, his face a mix of fear and fascination. The big tactical display showed a muddled mass of red and green dots representing the 36 capital ships parked in orbit around Io. The Rossi had marked all the Earth ships green and the Martian ships red. It created a confusing simplicity out of what was in actuality a far more complex situation. Holden knew that friend or foe identification was going to be a problem if anyone started shooting. For now, the various ships drifted quietly above Io, their enormous threat merely implied. They made Holden think of the crocodiles he'd seen at the zoo as a child, huge, armored, filled with teeth, but drifting on the surface of the water like statues, not even their eyes blinking. When food had been thrown into the pen, they'd exploded out of the water with frightening speed. We're just waiting for some blood to hit the water, he thought. Why isn't anyone shooting? Prax repeated.
Hey, Doc, Amos said. He was lounging in one of the crash couches next to Prax.
He projected a calm laziness that Holden wished he himself felt.
Remember how on Ganymede we were facing down those guys with guns, and no one was shooting right up until you decided to cock your gun?
Prax blanched. Holden guessed he was remembering the bloody aftermath of that fight. Yes, Prax said. I remember.
This is like that, Amos said. Only no one's cocked their gun just yet.
Prax nodded. Okay. If someone finally did break the whole situation loose, Holden knew that figuring out who was shooting at whom would be their first problem.
Avasarala, any word yet on the political landscape? There's a whole lot of green on that board. How many of those dots belong to us?
Avasarala shrugged and went on listening to the ship-to-ship crosstalk.
Naomi, Holden said, any ideas?
So far, Nguyen's fleet is targeting only Martian ships, she replied, marking ships on the main tactical board for everyone to see. The Martian ships are targeting back. Souther's ships aren't targeting anyone, and Souther hasn't even opened his tubes. I'm guessing he's still hoping for a peaceful resolution.
Please send the intel officer on Souther's ship my compliments, Holden said to Naomi, and ask him to get us some new IFF data so this doesn't turn into the solar system's biggest clusterfuck.
Done, Naomi said, and made the call.
Get everyone buttoned up in their suits, Amos, Holden continued. Do a hat check here before you go below. I hope we don't start shooting, but what I hope will happen and what actually happens are almost never the same.
Roger,
Amos said, then climbed out of his couch and began clumping around the deck on magnetic boots, checking the seals on everyone's helmets.
Test, 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 Holden said over the crew radio.
One by one, everyone on the ship responded with the affirmative. Until someone with a higher pay grade than his decided which way things were going to go, there wasn't much else he could do.
Wait, Avasarala said, then hit a button on her console and an outside channel started playing on their suit radios.
Launch immediately against targets on Mars. We have a battery of missiles carrying lethal biological weapon ready to fire. You have 1 hour to leave Io orbit, or we will launch immediately against targets on Mars. We have a...
Avasarala turned the channel off again.
It seems a third party has joined the circle jerk, Amos said.
No, Avasarala replied. It's Nguyen.
He's outnumbered, so he's ordered his Mao cronies on the surface to make the threat to back us off. He'll...
Oh, shit. She hit her panel again, and a new voice spoke over the radio. This one was a woman's voice, with a cultured Martian accent.
Io, this is Admiral Muhan of the Martian Congressional Republic Navy. You fire anything bigger than a bottle rocket and we will glass the whole fucking moon. Do you read me?
Amos leaned over to Prax.
Now, you see? All this is them cocking their guns.
Prax nodded. Got it.
This, Holden said, listening to the barely restrained fury in the Martian Admiral's voice, is about to get seriously out of hand.
This is Admiral Nguyen aboard the UNN Agatha King, a new voice said. Admiral Souther is here illegally at the behest of a civilian UN official with no military authority. I hereby order all ships under Admiral Souther's command to immediately stand down. I further order that the captain of Souther's flagship place the admiral under arrest for treason and...
Oh, do shut up, Souther replied over the same channel. I'm here as part of a legal fact-finding mission regarding improper use of UN funds and material for a secret biological weapon project on Io. A project which Admiral Nguyen is directly responsible for in contravention of UN directives.
Avasarala cut the link.
Oh, this ain't good, Alex said.
Well, Avasarala said, then opened the faceplate on her helmet and let out a long sigh.
She opened her purse and pulled a pistachio out of it. She cracked it and thoughtfully ate the meat, then put the shell in the nearby recycling chute. A tiny bit of the skin floated away in the microgravity.
No, actually, it should be fine. This is all posturing. As long as they keep comparing dicks, no one will shoot.
But we can't just wait here, Prax said, shaking his head. Amos was floating in front of him, checking his helmet. Prax shoved him away and tried to get to his feet. He drifted away from his crash couch, but didn't think to turn on his boot mags.
If May is down there, we have to go. They're talking about glassing the moon. We have to get there before they do it.
There was a high violin string whine at the back of Prax's voice. The tension was getting to him. It was getting to all of them, but Prax was the one who was going to show it worst and first. Holden shot a look at Amos, but the big man just looked surprised at having been pushed away by the much smaller scientist.
They're talking about destroying the base. We have to go down there,
Prax continued, the panic in his voice starting to shine through.
We're not doing anything, Holden said. Not until we have a better idea how this is going to shake out.
We came all this way so that we cannot do anything?
Prax demanded.
Doc, we don't want to be the ones to move first, Amos said, and put a hand on Prax's shoulder, pulling him back down to the deck.
The little botanist violently shrugged it off without turning around, then shoved off his couch toward Avasarala.
Give me the channel. Let me talk to them, Prax said, reaching for her comm panel. I can...
Holden launched himself out of his crash couch, catching the scientist mid-flight and hurling them both across the deck and into the bulkhead. The thick layer of anti-spalling padding absorbed their impact, but Holden felt the air go out of Prax when his hip slammed into the smaller man's belly.
Gah!
Prax said, and curled up into a floating fetal ball. Holden kicked on his boot mags and pushed himself down to the deck. He grabbed Prax and pushed him across the compartment to Amos.
Take him below, stuff him in his bunk, and sedate the shit out of him.
Then get to engineering and get us ready for a fight. Amos nodded and grabbed the floating prax.
Okay.
A moment later, the two of them disappeared down the deck hatch. Holden looked around the room, seeing the shocked looks from Avasarla and Naomi, but ignoring them. Prax's need for his daughter to take precedence over everything else had almost put them all in danger again. And while Holden intellectually understood the man's drive, having to stop him from killing them all every time May's name came up was stress he didn't need right then. It left him angry and needing to snap at someone.
Where the hell is Bobby?
He said to no one in particular. He hadn't seen her since they had put into orbit around Io.
Just saw her in the machine shop, Amos replied over the radio. She was field stripping my shotgun. I think she's doing all the guns and armor.
That's, Holden started, ready to yell about something.
That's actually really helpful. Tell her to button up her suit and turn her radio on. Things might be going south in a hurry here.
He took a few seconds to breathe and calm himself down, then returned to the combat operations station.
You okay?
Naomi asked over their private channel.
No,
he said, chinning the button to make sure only she heard his reply.
No, I'm actually scared to death.
I thought we were past that.
Past being scared?
No, she said, the smile audible in her voice. Past blaming yourself for it. I'm scared too.
I love you, Holden said, feeling that same electric thrill he always got when he told her. Part fear, part boast.
You should probably keep your eye on your station, she said, her tone teasing.
She never told him she loved him when he said it first. She'd said that when people did it too often, it made the word lose all its power. He understood the argument, but he'd kind of hoped she'd break her rule this once. He needed to hear it. Avasarla was hunched over the comm station like an ancient mystic peering into a murky crystal ball. The spacesuit hung on her like a scarecrow's oversized coveralls. Holden considered ordering her to button up her helmet, then shrugged. She was old enough to decide for herself the relative risks and rewards of eating during a battle. Periodically, she reached into her purse and pulled out another nut. The air around her was a growing cloud of tiny pieces of pistachio skin. It was annoying to watch her cluttering up his ship, but no warship was built so fragile that a little airborne waste would break anything. Either the tiny pieces of shell would be sucked into the air recycling system and trapped by the filters, or they'd go under thrust and all the garbage would fall to the floor where they could sweep it up. Holden wondered if Avasarla had ever had to clean anything in her life. While he watched her, the old lady cocked her head to one side, listening with sudden interest to something only she could hear. A new voice came over the ship's radios. This one with the faint hiss transmissions picked up when traveling for millions of kilometers through space.
General Esteban Sorrento Gillis. Some time ago, I announced the formation of an exploratory committee to look into possible misuse of UN resources for illegal biological weapon research. While that investigation is ongoing, and the committee is not prepared to bring charges at this time, in the interests of public safety and to better facilitate a thorough and comprehensive investigation, certain UN personnel in key positions are to be recalled to Earth for questioning. First, Admiral Augusto Nguyen of the United Nations Navy. Second, Avasarla hit the panel to shut off the feed and stared at the console with her mouth open for several seconds.
Oh, fuck me.
All over the ship, alarms started blaring. Chapter 48, Avasarla.
I've got fast movers, Naomi said over the blaring alarms. The UN flagship is firing.
Avasarla closed her helmet, watching the in-suit display confirm the seal, then tapped at the communications console, her mind moving faster than her hands. Aaron Wright had cut a deal, and now Nguyen knew it. The Admiral had just been hung out to dry, and he was taking it poorly. A flag popped up on the console, incoming high-priority broadcast. She thumbed it, and Souther appeared on her terminal and every other one in the ops deck. "This is Admiral Souther. I'm hereby taking command of..." "Okay," Naomi said, "I need my real screen back now, got some work to do." Sorry, Avasarala said, tapping at the console. "Wrong button." "This task force, Admiral Nguyen is relieved of duty. Any hostilities will be..." Avasarala switched the feed to her own screen, and in the process switched to a different broadcast. Nguyen was flushed almost purple. He was wearing his uniform like a boast. "Illegal and unprecedented seizure. Admiral Souther is to be escorted to the brig until..." 5 incoming comm requests lit up, each listing a name and short-form transponder ID. She ignored them all for the broadcast controls. As soon as the live button went active, she looked into the camera. "This is Assistant Undersecretary Christian Avasarala, representing the civilian government of Earth," she said. "Legal and appropriate command of this force is given to Admiral Souther. Anyone rejecting or ignoring his orders will be subject to legal action. I repeat, Admiral Souther is in legally authorized command of..." Naomi made a low, grunting sound. Avasarala stopped the broadcast and turned. "Okay," Holden said. "That was bad."
"What?"
Avasarala said.
"What was bad?"
"One of the Earth ships just took 3 torpedo hits."
"Is that a lot?"
"The PDCs aren't stopping them," Naomi said. "Those UN torpedoes all have transponder codes that mark them as friends, so they're sailing right through. They typically don't expect to be getting shot at by other UN ships."
3 is a lot," Holden said, strapping into the crash couch.
She didn't see him touch any of the controls, but he must have, because when he spoke, it echoed through the ship as well as the speakers in her helmet.
"We have just gone live. Everyone has to the count of 20 to get strapped in someplace safe. Solid copy on that,"
Bobby replied from wherever she was on the ship.
"Just got the doc strapped in and happy," Amos said. "I'm on my way to engineering."
"Are we heading into this?"
Alex asked.
"We've got something like 35 capital ships out there, all of them much, much bigger than us. How about we just try to keep anyone from shooting us full of holes?"
"Yes, sir,"
Alex said from the pilot's deck. Any vestige of democracy and vote-taking was gone. That was a good thing. At least Holden had control when there had to be a single voice in command.
"I have 2 fast movers coming in," Naomi said. "Someone still thinks we're the bad guys."
"I blame Avasarala," Bobby said.
Before Avasarala could laugh, gravity ticked up and slewed to the side, the Rosinante taking action beneath her. Her couch shifted and creaked. The protective gel squeezed her and let her go.
"Alex?"
"On 'em," Alex said. "I wouldn't mind getting a real gunner, sir."
"Are we going to have enough time to get her up here safely?"
"Nope," Alex said. "I've got 3 more incoming."
"I can take PDC control from here, sir," Bobby said. "It's not the real thing, but it's something the rest of you won't have to do."
"Naomi, give the PDCs to the sergeant."
"PDC control transferred. It's all yours, Bobby."
"Taking control," Bobby said.
Avasarala's screen was a tangle of incoming messages in a flickering array. She started going through them. The Kennedy was announcing that Souther's command was illegal. The Triton's first officer was reporting that the captain had been relieved of duty and requested orders from Souther. The Martian destroyer Ione Chaos was trying to reach Avasarala for clarification of which Earth ships it was permitted to shoot at. She pulled up the tactical display. Circles in red and green marked the swarm of ships. Tiny silver thread showed what might have been streams of PDC fire, or the paths of torpedoes.
Are we red or green? Avasarala asked. Who's who on this fucking thing?
Mars is red, Earth is green, Naomi said.
And which Earth ones are on our side?
Find out, Holden said as one of the green dots suddenly vanished. Alex?
The Darius took the safeties off its PDCs, and now it's spraying down everything in range, whether it's friend or foe. And shit.
Avasarala's chair shifted again, seeming to rise from under her, pressing her back into the gel until it was hard to lift her arms. On the tactical screen, the cloud of ships, enemy and friendly and ambiguous, shifted slightly, and two golden dots grew larger, proximity notations beside them counting quickly down.
Madam Assistant, whatever you are, Holden said, you could respond to some of those comm requests now.
Avasarala's gut felt like someone was squeezing it from below. The taste of salt and stomach acid haunted the back of her tongue. She was beginning to sweat in a way that had less to do with temperature than nausea. She forced her hands out to the control panel just as the two golden dots vanished.
Thank you, Bobby, Alex said. I'm heading up. Gonna try to get the Martians between us and the fighting.
She started making calls. In the heat of a battle, all she had to offer was this. Making calls. Talking. The same thing she always did. Something about it was actually reassuring. The Greenville was accepting Souther's command. The Tanaka wasn't responding. The Dyson opened the channel, but the only sound was men shouting at each other. It was bedlam. A message came in from Souther, and she accepted it. It included a new IFF code, and she manually accepted the update. On the tactical, most of the green dots shifted to white.
Thank you, Holden said.
Avasarala swallowed her, you're welcome. The anti-nausea drug seemed to be working for everyone else. She really, really didn't want to throw up inside her helmet. One of the six remaining green dots blinked out of existence, and another turned suddenly to white.
Oh, right in the back, Alex said. That was cold.
Souther's ID showed up again on Avasarala's console, and she hit accept just as the Rossi shifted again.
The immediate surrender of the flagship King and Admiral Augusto Nguyen, Souther was saying.
His shock of white hair was standing up off his head as if the low thrust gravity was letting it expand like a peacock's tail. His smile was sharp as a knife.
Any vessel that still refuses to acknowledge my orders as legal and legitimate will forfeit this amnesty. You have 30 seconds from this mark.
On the tactical display, the threads of silver and gold had, for the most part, vanished. The ships shifted positions, each moving along its own complex vectors. As she watched, all the remaining green dots turned to white. All except one.
Don't be an asshole, Nguyen, Avasarala said. It's over.
The ops deck was silent for a long moment, the tension almost unbearable. Naomi's voice was the one to break it.
I've got more fast movers. Oh, I've got a lot of them.
Where? Holden snapped.
From the surface.
Avasarala didn't do anything, but her tactical display resized, pulling back until the cluster of ships, red and white and the single defiant green, were less than a quarter of their original size, and the massive curve of the moon's surface impinged on the lower edge of the display. Rising like a solid mass, hundreds of fine yellow lines.
Get me a count, Holden said. I need a count here. 219. No, wait, 230.
What the hell are they? Are those torpedoes?
Alex asked.
No, Bobby said. They're monsters. They launched the monsters.
Avasarala opened a broadcast channel. Her hair probably looked worse than Souther's, but she was well past vanity. that she could speak without fear of vomiting was blessing enough.
"This is Avasarala," she said. "The launch you are all seeing right now is a new protomolecule-based weapon that is being used as an unauthorized first strike against Mars. We need to shoot those fuckers out of the sky and do it now. Everyone."
"We've got a coordination override request coming through from Souther's flagship," Naomi said. "Surrender control?"
"The hell I will,"
Alex said. "No, but track requests," Holden said. "I'm not handing control of my ship to a military fire control computer, but we still need to be part of the solution here."
"The King's starting a hard burn," Alex said. "I think he's trying to hightail it."
On the display, the attack from the surface of Io was beginning to bloom. Individual threads coming apart in unexpected angles, some corkscrewing, some reaching out in bent paths like an insect's articulated legs. Any one of them was the death of a planet. And the acceleration data put them at 10, 15, 20 Gs. Nothing human survived at a sustained 20 G. Nothing human had to. Golden flickers of light appeared from the ships, drifting down to meet the threads of Io. The slow, stately pace of the display was undercut by the data. Plasma torpedoes burning full out, and yet it took long seconds for them to reach the main stem. Avasarala watched the first of them detonate, saw the column of protomolecule monsters split into a dozen different streams. Evasive action.
"Some of those are coming toward us, Cap," Alex said. "I don't think they're designed to hold a ship's hull, but I'm pretty damn sure they'd do it anyway."
"Let's get in there and do what we can. We can't let any of these..." "Okay, where'd they go?" On the tactical display, the attacking monsters were blinking out of existence, the threads vanishing. "They're cutting thrust," Naomi said. "And the RF transponders are going dark. Must have radar-absorbing hull materials."
"Do we have tracking data? Can we anticipate where they're going to be?"
The tactical display began to flicker. Fireflies. The monsters shifting in and out, thrusting in what looked like semi-random directions, but the bloom of them always expanding.
"This is going to be a bitch," Alex said. "Bobby?
I've got some target locks. Get us in PDC range."
"Hang on, kids," Alex said. "We're going for a ride."
The Rossi bucked hard, and Avasarala pressed back into her seat. The shuddering rhythm seemed to be her own trembling muscles, and then the firing PDCs, and then her body again. On the display, the combined forces of Earth and Mars spread out, running after the near-invisible foes. Thrust gravity shifted, spinning her couch one way and then another without warning. She tried closing her eyes, but that was worse.
"Hmm.
What, Naomi?" Holden said.
"Hmm, what?"
"The King was doing something strange there. Huge activity from the maneuvering thrusters and... oh."
"Oh, what? Nouns. I need nouns."
"She's holed," Naomi said. "One of the monsters holed her."
"Told you they could do that," Alex said. "Hate to be on the ship right now. Still, couldn't have happened to a nicer fella."
"His men aren't responsible for his actions," Bobby said. "They may not even know Souther's in command. We've got to help them."
"We can't," Holden said. "They'll shoot at us."
"Would you all please shut the fuck up," Avasarala said, "and stop moving the goddamn ship around. Just pick a direction and calm down for 2 minutes."
Her calm request went ignored for 5 minutes, then 10. When the King's distress beacon kicked in, she still hadn't answered. A broadcast signal came in just after.
"This is Admiral Nguyen of the United Nations battleship Agatha King. I am offering to surrender to UN ships with the condition of immediate evacuation. Repeat, I am offering surrender to any United Nations military vessel on the condition of immediate evacuation."
Souther answered on the same frequency.
This is the Okimbo. What's your situation?
We have a possible biohazard, Nguyen said.
His voice was so tight and high, it sounded like someone was strangling him. On the tactical display, several white dots were already moving toward the green.
Hold tight, King, Souther said. We're on our way.
Like hell you are,
Avasala said, then cursed quietly as she opened a broadcast channel.
Like hell you are. This is Avasarala. I am declaring a quarantine and containment order on the Agatha King. No vessel should dock with her or accept transfer of materiel or personnel. Any ship that does will be placed under a quarantine and containment order as well.
Two of the white dots turned aside. Three others continued on. She opened the channel again.
Am I the only one here who remembers Eros? What the fuck do you people think is loose on the King? Do not approach.
The last of the white dots turned aside. When Nguyen answered her calm request, she'd forgotten she still had it open. He looked like shit. She didn't imagine she looked much better. How many wars had ended this way, she wondered. Two exhausted, nauseated people staring at each other while the world burned around them.
What more do you want from me? Nguyen said. I've surrendered. I lost. My men shouldn't have to die for your spite.
It's not spite, Avasarala said. We can't do it. The protomolecule gets loose. Your fancy control programs don't work. It's infectious.
That's not proven, he said.
But the way he said it told her everything.
It's happening, isn't it? She said.
Turn on your internal cameras. Let us see. I'm not going to do that.
She felt the air go out of her. It had happened.
I am so sorry, Avasarala said. Oh, I am so sorry.
Nguyen's eyebrows rose a millimeter. His lips pressed, bloodless and thin. She thought there were tears in his eyes, but it might have been only a transmission artifact.
You have to turn on the transponders, Avasarala said.
And then, when he didn't reply,
we can't weaponize the protomolecule. We don't understand what it is. We can't control it. You just sent a death sentence to Mars. I can't save you. I cannot. But turn those transponders back on and help me save them.
The moment hung in the air. Avasarala could feel Holden's and Naomi's attention on her like warmth radiating from the heating grate. Nguyen shook his head, his lips twitching, lost in conversation with himself.
Nguyen, she said, what's happening on your ship? How bad is it?
Get me out of here, and I'll turn the transponders on, he said. Throw me in the brig for the rest of my life, I don't care, but get me off of this ship.
Avasarala tried to lean forward, but it only made her crash couch shift. She looked for the words that would bring him back, the ones that would tell him that he had been wrong and evil, and now he was going to die badly at the hands of his own weapon, and somehow make it all right. She looked at this angry, small, short-sighted, frightened little man and tried to find the way to pull him back to simple, human decency. She failed.
I can't do that, she said.
Then stop wasting my time,
he said and cut the connection. She lay back, her palm over her eyes.
I'm getting some mighty strange readings off that battleship, Alex said. Naomi, are you seeing this?
Sorry, give me a second.
What have you got, Alex? Holden asked.
Reactor activity's down. Internal radiation through the ship spiking huge. It's like they're venting the reactor into the air recycling.
That don't sound healthy, Amos said.
The ops deck went silent again. Avasarala reached to open a channel to Souther, but stopped. She didn't know what she'd say. The voice that came over the